Let me ask you, as we begin our time here today, for brave individuals of you to stand and tell me why you're here. Why you're in this particular workshop this morning. What are your thoughts?
Okay.
Yes.
Hi. I'm going to be graduating. Oh, Stan, I'll be graduating, and I'm not sure what I want to do. So that's why I'm here.
Good.
I want to get some of his thoughts.
An honest man. Very good. Graduating and you don't know what to do. Yep. Why are the rest of you here? Yes.
Well, I'll say something then.
Please do.
I'm graduating and I know what I'm going to do as far as vocation or occupation.
Uh-huh.
But vocation I'm not real sure. Meaning, what am I going to do in ministry?
Oh, so you're talking about ministry.
So I thought maybe you could have some insight in that.
Maybe. Who else? Why are you here? Kill time? Any other brave souls here want to tell us why you're here? Yes, behind him. You were going to stand, weren't you?
Yeah, well, I want to sit down. But, I'm going to kind of say my goals on a profession to use, as like one guy said, I'm a Christian. Heavily disguised as a businessman. So I want to get a doctorate in history and teach. And I want to find what is the balance in being a professional and doing the best job I can, but yet also where I'm not driven and so consumed by it that I can't do my life better. So.
Okay. Very good. Very good. Any other questions, thoughts, reasons why you're here? This is a hard crowd to play today here. Okay, well, let's launch off and see if I can get your blood moving here a little bit. My name is Dave Fromm, and I've been on the Navigator staff for 12 years. The last 3 years we've been here at Glen Eyrie, and the first 9 years we're up in the frozen chosen area of Wisconsin. And came out here 3 years ago. I guess I said that. While I was in Wisconsin and on the campus staff, I began to realize that people were something before I ever saw them. Before I put them through my little preconceived discipleship box and tried to make them into something, they were already something. They had unique patterns and designs to them. And somewhere along the line, God impressed upon me the idea that I needed to simply find out what that was, who that individual was, and enhance it. That God had designed this individual uniquely for His purposes. And if I was to violate that, I would be to violate God. So my whole scheme of ministry changed, and I said, okay, God, I want to simply enhance uniqueness. What is it that You've put in these individuals that You want to have me be part of building? I began to look around at some of the people that left the campus, graduated, and most, in all honesty, fell flat on their face because we had trained them in how to minister, but they had no idea about vocation. We trained people to help people grow in Christ, but we gave them no ideas about where they would fit into God's world of work, where they would function most effectively. So over the last 6 years, I've been studying and observing and increasing my awareness that the thing I really wanted to give my life to was this whole idea of helping people discover where they best fit into this world of work. I'm 36 now, and I can say that my vocational purpose in life, the thing that's out here that drives me, that motivates me, that moves me within the realm of serving God, is to help individuals identify who they really are and then invest that strategically in God's world. So you have before you what is called the Great Niche Hunt. It's a workshop format. I'm part of a team called the Barnabas Team within the Navigators, and the whole focus of what we do is to help individuals understand their design, how God has designed them, and where they would function best. It has implications on the whole area of Christian leadership. I'm working on a book called The Great Niche Hunt, and today you are part of my guinea pigs. As I gain responses from you and understand more about you, you'll help me understand how to write this book. Let me begin now by sharing some of my thoughts with you. Quite a bit of this will be informational. You'll be taking in a great deal of information. We'll be doing a little evaluation of some individuals that you'll see later in your packet here. And then we'll have some time for questions and answers and I don't knows. Yes?
Before you get lost, do you have any more of those?
I sure do. Anybody else need one? There you be. I gave you a little format so you can write notes if you want to. So if you fall asleep, when you wake up, you'll know where we're at. An old Howard Hendricks joke. The first thing I want to talk to you about is the whole issue of wandering. Some statistics about this. In a recent Boston University survey done throughout the United States, they came to the conclusion that 50% of all working Americans believe they're in wrong jobs. 50%. I would hazard a guess that it's probably higher than that. Individuals who believe they're in the wrong work in God's world. Not long ago, my wife and I sat in a fellowship meeting in a friend's house. There were about 30 of us. We were all in our 30s and 40s. And the host, between refills on coffee, offered this question, posed this question for us each to answer. He said, if time and money were of no issue, what would you be doing with your life? And the question drifted around the room, and each one addressed themselves to it from a point of vocation. Out of 30 people, there are only three who felt a satisfaction with what they were doing with their work. 27 people said, I'd really like to change. I don't know what it is I'd like to do, but I know that what I'm doing now isn't it. Another survey done by Princeton University said that there may be as many as 80% of us who are in wrong work, who aren't in a vocation that fits how God has designed us. A couple of guys, a guy named Ralph Matson and another guy named Arthur Miller, wrote a book called Finding a Job You Can Love. A couple of Christian guys. Together, they developed an assessment process that allowed them to gather feedback on individuals and how they function best, and then to interview a variety of people with this assessment process. They found that 2/3 of all teachers in America are not motivated to teach. Yikes! 2/3 are not motivated to teach. The other day, I heard a teacher say the best three reasons to teach are June, July, and August. 2/3 are not motivated to teach. Matson and Miller went on to say that examining managers and executives, only 1 out of 3 are really fit for the job they do. Examining managers and executives, we have found that only 1 out of 3 appears well matched to his job. My friend Scott works for a Christian organization. Some would say, well, he's found his place then. Because after all, he works directly for God, right? Yet in the mornings, as Scott sits at his desk and he gets ready to do personal interviews with people, one-on-one time and Bible study leading and so forth, he sits there and dreams about doing something else. In fact, he says, as I sit in my office, my heart really yearns to farm. But I have to wonder, am I being selfish? Am I overlooking the great needs of the city? Will people think I'm quitting or deserting them? How would my wife and kids adjust? Scott feels trapped. He really knows what he'd like to do, but he questions the value of it. Does God think farming is important? Some of his friends, some of his well-meaning friends, have the same questions. Is farming important? I have a friend named Susan. She's been selling insurance for 13 years. She hates it. She sits in my office and we talk about who she really is and does her job fit her God-given design? What is it that she really wants to gain from and give to God's world? She's done what others have expected her to do for so long that she can't answer that question. She doesn't really know what she wants to give to God's world. She's tired. Very tired. She's burnt out. I have a friend named Steve. He's a college student. He's close to graduation, about this far away. He says this, "My dilemma as I see it is that I've gotten my life all planned out, but without any consideration as to what I really want to do, what I'd be good at. I feel like I've jumped on this never-ending merry-go-round and I just don't know how to get off. Like I'm going through life without rhyme or reason. I don't know where to jump." You see, Steve's coursework doesn't reflect what he really wants to give to his world. And he's just about to be launched off in a direction that he's really not sure he wants to take. Janelle's another friend. She's a homemaker. "I feel like my husband is supporting me as a home missionary," she says. "I'm a Sunday school teacher for ninth grade girls, a youth group counselor, a board member for women's ministry serving 250 women, a teacher of seventh and eighth grade girls at a Laotian church, and just finished a discipleship Bible study with a gal I led to Christ a year ago." She goes on to say, "I need reassurance. I need to know that I'm not wasting my time, since I could be investing all this energy in a business or a career that would provide a pension program of some kind." Janelle and her husband are about to have a baby. They've moved into a big house. Janelle is really struggling for a sense of vocational identity. Where do I fit? Got a friend named Dave, and he works in the publishing industry. He's developed a sound job record. He'd like a new challenge. He'd like a new position with a new company, one in which advancement is possible, to become the best market researcher possible. But then he goes on to say this, "Recently I've been wondering whether or not that goal might be too small from an eternal perspective. I'm wondering whether I would find more real satisfaction working as a support person for a Christian organization whose goals I agree with, knowing that the 40 to 50 daytime hours I spend at my job are really counting for something in the long run." Dave was wondering, does what I do in this world really count? Finally, I got a friend named Bill. He's an excellent study in entrepreneurship. He sits across the table for me and whispers all these stories of past adventures in the jungle of the business world. He's owned 8 different restaurants. I want to hear more about what he's doing. His world is much different than mine. It's filled with risky initiatives to earn money. And yet he sits and he asks, you know, am I really taking care of my family? He wonders if he's in the right place. Where do I fit? Every one of these stories, the individual is wondering, where do I fit? Yes, I'm a believer. Yes, I'm a Christian. Yes, I minister to people. But what do I do? What's my platform? What's my vocation? Where do I fit into God's vast world of work? Each is wandering in what I call the wilderness. wandering in the wilderness, wondering where they fit. There's a tragedy involved here, see? Point two, the tragedy. The tragedy is not the wandering, and it's not the searching, and it's not the questioning, and it's not the wondering, but it's in the never leaving the wilderness. Never leaving to find your niche, where you really function best for your Creator. Finding your vocational purpose and place in God's world. There may be as many as 80% of your fellow human being Americans who are in the wrong place. That includes Christians. A national study of over half or a quarter million 1982 college freshmen indicated that only 5.6 of them, some of them maybe you, intend to seek vocational guidance. The majority of college seniors we see are not sure what they want to do, says Lisa Heiser. She works at the University of Minnesota in the career development office in the School of Liberal Arts. She says the majority of these students have no idea what they want to do. So when they graduate, they come to the doorstep of the placement office and say, I just need a job. They're wandering in the wilderness, not knowing where they fit. But college students aren't the only ones who have a corner. They don't have a corner on the market of wandering in the wilderness. A mother of a daughter who was in one of my career directions classes made this comment. She said to her daughter, don't worry too much about finding work that fits you, that you really enjoy. I've been through all that before. It's a phase. Work is sort of like marriage. First you think it's going to be great. You're all excited and everything, but then you get used to it. And then pretty soon you're just putting up with the whole thing, trying to get what you can out of it. Now there's a woman who's been in the wilderness all her life. And unfortunately, she wants the same thing for her daughter. Eventually, that mentality catches up to the individual. For many of us, it comes as what is commonly called a midlife crisis. Not long ago, an older woman confided to me, she said, for all these years, I've always done what the company has required and wanted. And now I'm trying to figure out who I am and what I really want to give and get from life. This so-called midlife crisis is becoming earlier and earlier in our society. It's hitting the 30-something bunch these days. The baby boom bunch. All of us who were born between 1946 and 64. Most of you are younger than that. You're in a new generation. You're in the yuppie puppy generation. Have you heard that term? The yuppie puppy. So I'm part of the baby boomers. There's shows made about us. 30-something is a baby boom show. The struggles of individuals trying to understand their identity. The Wonder Years is built upon the presupposition of the baby boom movement. This whole idea of people trying to figure out where they fit is starting earlier and earlier in life in this midlife crisis thing. All that aside, however, imagine yourself, you, the individual God has created. Think in terms of 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, 50 weeks a year, over the next 40 years, 80,000 working hours in work that you could really care less about, that you hate, because you never took the time to figure out where you fit. 80,000 hours over 40 years is simply vocational suicide. Not very good PR for the creator of work himself, is it? Punching a clock or doing something else, just going through the motions, because you got trapped. That's discouraging. Bottom line, there are simply a lot of people wandering through the world of work, lacking a clear sense of vocational purpose and place. Why should we add to that number? Why should we, who relate directly to the God of the world, add to that number? According to the statistics I've shared with you, you have a very high chance of adding to that number. Unless you do a couple of things that I'm about to present to you. You know, we can send men to the moon, but we can't get a Xerox machine to make good overheads. Mine broke down on me yesterday. This was to be my next overhead. There are two things that you need to have a clear perspective on if you're going to find a sense of where you fit. The one is a true biblical perspective on work. The second one is knowing your God-given self. Two things. Work and you. Who are you? In my book and in other classes, we go into a great deal of this thing about self. We live in a generation in which self has become very predominant in the non-Christian world. And because so, the Christian world has rebelled against a study of the individual self. And it's complete stupidity. We need to understand who God has created us to be. We need not let the pendulum swing full ride to the other side and ignore self. We must understand who we are. Turn to the next page, if you would, in your workshop handout. And let's focus for a while on this issue of work. By the way, if you have any questions or comments, feel free to just interject and raise your hand. What is work? Ever really thought about that? The whole concept of work. Some would say it's a four-letter word. Work is a four-letter word. On the bumper sticker of cars in the United States, that's where all sociologists learn the truth. It says, "Help, I'm a POW, a prisoner of work. I-O, so it's off to work I go." Is work something God has created to keep man busy? Perhaps it's something God created to punish us? Perhaps others might think it's simply a necessary evil. We must do this in order to meet our needs. Well, I'd like to present a different idea. I'd like to present the definition of work as God's self-expression. In Genesis 2, verses 2 and 3, very interesting little snapshot. It says, "By the seventh day, God had finished the work." That's the first time God had, or that the word work was used in the scriptures. "By the seventh day, God had finished the work that he had been doing. So on the seventh day, he rested from all his work. And God blessed the seventh day and made it holy because on it he rested from all the work of creating that he had done." I'm going to ask you to think then in terms of the fact that work, foundationally, biblically, at the beginning, was simply God's self-expression. All that exists, as you look around Glen Eyrie, as you look at yourselves, as you look at everything, all that exists is there only because God has expressed himself. King David wrote, "Yours, O Lord, is the greatness and the power and the glory and the majesty and the splendor, for everything on heaven and earth is yours. Yours, O Lord, is the kingdom. You are exalted as head over all." Work is God's self-expression. what does that mean to you and I? Work. What is that to you and I? I will suggest that man's work, what you are preparing yourselves to do as collegians, is to participate with God in His self-expression, in His world. Now that, my friends, puts a new view on work. There is no way you can consider work a four-letter word. If you have the right perspective, you are simply participating with God in His self-expression. Genesis 1, 26 and 27 says, "You were created in His image. You are part of His self-expression. You were also created to express yourselves." You follow that? You are self-expressive individuals. You have the image of God. He is self-expressive, so are you. We know, of course, that in the garden, that was violated, that was corrupted. Adam and Eve expressed themselves independently from their Creator. That is sin. We know also, those of us who are believers, that in Christ, we're brought back into that fellowship, into that relationship with God. We're restored to the original potential of participating with God in His self-expression. Our self-expression is reunited with His. In Genesis 1, it talks about the nature of man's self-expression. Part of it is a co-ruling with Him over His world as His representative. Key word here is representative. Our self-expression in His world is to be a co-ruling with Him over His world as His representative. And then there's another element, a participating with Him as His steward. God took man and put him in the garden. He became His representative and His steward in taking care of His world. You and I are God's representative stewards. I believe from Genesis 1 and 2 you can make a sound argument for that. We are to represent Him in His world. That's a value. That's a ministry. That's a statement of value. And we are to be His stewards. That's a statement of function. There are values and functions. We are to be Christ-like. That's a value. Some of us are to be farmers. That's a function. Some of us are to be teachers. That's a function. The world is full of functions, and bottom line, all functions, all legitimate functions, are God's. Let me explain that a little bit more. Here's my next overhead. All legitimate work in God's world is God's work. I use the word legitimate because there is some work that violates the values of God. In Loving God by Charles Colson, he talks about a gangster named Mickey Cohen, I believe it was, who supposedly came to Christ and wanted to continue in his vocational direction. Gangster for God. That's an obvious violation of God's values. There are other vocations that aren't so clear-cut as to whether or not they violate God's values. I knew a friend who drove a beer truck. And in his conscience, he couldn't continue to do so as a Christian. So he took a big cut in pay and is now driving a milk truck. I have another friend who delivers wine to bars for his dad. His dad owns a liquor company. And he has no problem with it. The Holy Spirit has not convicted him that it's sin for him. Nor do I. I can't. So there are some vocations, you know, about what is legitimate and what is not. But there are some that are very obviously violational to God's value system. All legitimate work in God's world is God's work. A guy named Doug Sherman, along with a fellow named William Hendricks, have written a book called Your Work Matters to God. Excellent book on this issue of work. They say over time, we have gradually, in the body of Christ, equated God's work with church work. Consequently, we assume that serving God means serving the church. They quote a guy named Elton Trueblood who says it's a gross error to suppose that the Christian cause goes forward solely or chiefly on weekends. What happens on the regular weekdays may be far more important. What happens in the working world far more important so far as the Christian faith is concerned than what happens on Sundays. I grew up in the Midwest. Went to the University of Iowa. And back then, when I came to the Lord, we had sort of this rally call. Sell the farm. Sell the farm. And what that meant to us, who understood that phrase, was an emphasis on values. That nothing else in all the world would take a higher priority in our lives than Jesus. Sell the farm. Unfortunately, that statement of value began to be read by others as a function. Sell the farm began to be a functional statement. That farming is not for the Christian. Suppose Mr. Bruss said, you know, I'm doing so well at painting, I'm going to try to do a little hammering. He'd have some nails that were very sad. And Mr. Brush would eventually reach a midlife crisis. He'd fall apart. On one hand, you're a poem. Another metaphor is you're also a tool. Uniquely designed by the toolmaker to bring certain things into his world. To function in certain ways. With the values of Christ-likeness. Helping others to see Jesus. But you function very, very much differently from each other. You need to think about your function and where you fit into work, into self-expression with God. You have what might be called a functional design. You do things in certain ways. That's where the expression, isn't that just like him, comes from. You have a pattern. There's a pattern to your poem. There is a way you function best. And it fits only certain places. One of the clearest pictures of this in the Scriptures is the Apostle Paul. If you trace his history through passages like Acts 26, 4 and 5, according to the strictest sect of our religion, I lived as a Pharisee before Christ, Paul says of himself. Acts 22, 3 through 5, I'm thoroughly trained, I'm zealous for this cause against what he called the way, the believers. He persecuted the followers of Christ. He arrested men and women and threw them in prison. He obtained letters and went after people. Acts 9, breathing murderous threats. Who was this individual, Paul? He was an aggressive, persevering overcomer. Those are a couple words I call him. I mean, he has a design. This is Paul. What was he like after he came to Christ? The same joking way. He functioned the same way. His values changed. Now he served Christ rather than against him. He was the same way. God created him this way, and that's why God used him, because of his who he was. It's a mistake for any of you ever, ever to say, I want to be just like Paul. You want to be just like you. Who are you? Paul was Paul. After he came to Christ, Acts 13, he says to a dude, you are a child of the devil, an enemy of everything that is right. In Galatians 2, 11 through 14, when Peter came to Antioch, Paul says, I opposed him face to face because he was clearly wrong. 2 Corinthians 11, 5, but I do not think of myself in the least inferior to those super apostles, those false guys, Paul says. Acts 15, 37 through 39, Barnabas wanted to bring Mark along. Paul said, no way! And they had a big fight. This was Paul. He was an aggressive, overcoming, persevering overcomer. Who else could have written something like this? I have worked much harder, been in prison more frequently, been flogged more severely, been exposed to death again and again. 5 times I received from the Jews the 40 lashes minus one. 3 times I was beaten by rods. 1 I was stoned. 3 I was shipwrecked. I spent a night and a day in the open sea. I have been constantly on the move. I have been in danger from rivers, in danger from bandits, in danger from my own countrymen, in danger from Gentiles, in danger from the city, in danger in the country, in danger at sea, and in danger from false brothers. I have labored and toiled and have often gone without sleep. I have known hunger and thirst and have often gone without food. I have been cold and naked. Besides everything else, I face the daily pressures of concern for all the churches. He was a unique poem. Then you get a guy like Barnabas. Barnabas, facilitative encourager. Now, we don't know what he was like before Christ. But if what I'm saying to you is true, he had the same functional design before his values changed when he reunited with the Lord. Barnabas. He's the guy, the Joseph, his name was Joseph, he's the guy that brought all this money in Acts 4 and gave it to the disciples to carry on the training program there. Acts 9, he's the guy that when Paul, after his conversion, came to the brothers in Jerusalem, they all didn't want to have anything to do with him. Barnabas put his arm around him, took him under his wing. Barnabas, in fact, is the guy that got Paul into the ministry, into this small team of people that he gathered together to minister in Antioch. An interesting sidelight of all this, hopefully many of you are familiar with this, Paul and Barnabas had this little team going. It was called Barnabas and Saul in Acts 13. In that same chapter, it reverses and it's called Paul and his companions. Barnabas allowed Paul to take over the leadership of it because of his gifts. That's when John left the team. Isn't that interesting? My perception is that John Mark, couldn't stand Paul. I probably couldn't either. His style would grate against me. And I believe it probably grated against John Mark. When it was Barnabas and Saul, John felt very comfortable because of who Barnabas was and his style of leadership. When it became Paul and companions, when this aggressive guy took over, it became hard for John Mark. That's not to say any of that was bad. Different styles were at work. Who would you consider vocationally to have been the best art teacher, Paul or Barnabas? Barnabas, of course. How about insurance salesman? Paul, of course. How about career counselor? Barnabas. See, things begin to make sense when you understand, man, these guys function the same way. What would be the best astronaut? Paul. Right? Of course. Turn to the next page in your handout. The great niche hunt process of assessing functional design begins with a model of functional man. You have your model in front of you there. Each element within this model is considered a stanza of a poem. Within each one of the stanzas, your functional design is discovered as a recurring style or a pattern of preferences that really show the rhyme and the reason as to why you function in certain ways. Your style of perceiving. God is all-knowing. Man is a cognitive being. I will show you in a little bit how you can discern your particular style of learning about your world. And that's really key. I have a secretary who doesn't learn by reading. She learns by seeing it done. And we just got Apple computers and networked throughout the international office building down here. She hasn't touched a manual. She has to have an expert come show her how to do it. Thankfully, we've got a guy like that in our office building who knows how to synthesize manuals into pass-onable things for individuals who don't read by learning. Knowing that she doesn't learn by reading, I know how to approach her. I know what to give her and what not to give her, what to expect from her and what not to expect from her, what type of help she will need and what type she doesn't need. Style of evaluating. God is judge. Man is an evaluative being. This is the element to help us understand how you prefer to draw conclusions about your world. Style of structuring. God brings order. You, all of you, are orderly beings. There's a certain way you prefer to bring structure to your world. Every one of you is creative because you've been designed in the image of the Creator. God is a creator. Man is a creative being. How you prefer to bring things into being in your world. There are three forms of creativity. One is an originating, another is a modifying, and the third is a producing. I happen to be a modifier. I love to take somebody else's thing and make it better, or make it a little different, or make it my own. I love to modify things. Style of communicating, how you express yourself communicatively. There are certain forms you like to take. I love to write letters, for instance. And there are functions that those forms take. There are three functions: informing, influencing, and illuminating. Your style of manual expression. How you prefer to exert yourself physically. Recently, I interviewed a navigator staff from South America. And part of his design is strong in the areas of working with his hands. It comes out in all of his stories about what he's done in his life that he really enjoyed. Well, he's in this full-time ministry, and he kept getting busier and busier with all these different things. And every time he took on a new project in the ministry, he gave up a little bit more of working with his hands. He collapsed. He broke down. Emotional breakdown, burnout. When we looked at his whole functional design, we realized he just didn't have enough time working with his hands. So he backed off a great deal of all this other stuff and added building a barn in his backyard. He's got every tool imaginable to man. He needs that in order to function well in God's world. Style of teamworking. there are three different styles, a managing or an influencing and a contributing style. And I won't explain those right now. And then there are preferred environments, contexts in which you prefer to function, preferred elements, content with which you prefer to function, and preferred rewards, or results towards which you prefer to function. This epilogue here is an issue that this is really a format that I use when I do a professional evaluation of an individual. I do a little integration of this design with the desires they tell me about. If you would, turn to the next page. It should be pink. And this is an individual named Lisa. And I've collected from her just some simple one-line statements about things she's enjoyed accomplishing in her personal history. I thought it would be fun for us to take both Lisa and Gil. Gil's on the next page. And right now, I want you to learn as much as you can about her. Lisa's functional design. And I want you to focus just on two stanzas, on her preferred elements, and environments. Feel free to circle things or write things out or whatever. I want you to tell me who Lisa is. The elements she likes to work with, and the environments within which she likes to function. Take a few minutes, read through that. Feel free to discuss it with somebody next to you if you'd like to. Pardon? Next. Okay, you had 3 minutes to read about Lisa. What have you learned about her? What does she like to work with, element-wise? Pardon? Okay, we'll put that under environments. What are the elements she likes to work with? Fabric, okay. Just yell them out here. Clay? What else? Food? Ideas. Okay. Where would you find people here? Okay. So there would be an element of that there, wouldn't it? What else? Anything else you learned about Lisa? Are you sure? Okay. Create. So she needs a creative environment, right? And instead of leading, I would say she needs recognition. We don't have enough information here yet to know if she really likes to lead. But we do know that she likes to have her work hung in the library. And by the way, before we go any further, in this functional design, you make no value statements. You understand what I'm saying by that? Lisa was designed to want recognition. That's fine. That's valuable. I'm up here in front of you because I love to be up here in front of you. I love it. You make no value statements in understanding your functional design. Some would say this is arrogant. Bull. This is how God created her, to enjoy recognition. Now she has to deal with surrender to Jesus and His authority. Right? Why do actors and actresses like what they do? They like an audience. That's great. If you like an audience, figure out work where you can do it in front of an audience. Hands-on, creative, recognition, those are all true to Lisa's environmental needs in order to function best for her Creator. Elements are divided into three. Always remember that. They're people, information, and things. She's really big on things and information. People, we need more information to know whether she really likes to work with people. There's an element in which people are involved here, but is she really working with them or with the information and the things that help them? When she helped her mother decorate, what was she really working with? Things. You follow what I'm saying there? So you're looking for what are they directly working with? I'm really not sure about Lisa's people here. Really strong on this. Okay. Now, she make a good what? From the limited amount you know about her, a good what?
Designer,
yeah. Interior decorator, too. She'd make a terrible engineer. Engineers have to think in straight lines. Maybe? She'd make a great artist. Creative artist. She'd make a horrendous accountant. Creative accountants wind up in jail. They have to think in straight lines. Numbers don't show up in what she likes to work with, element-wise, right? Clothing designer. Wonderfully. She loves to work with fabrics and things and materials and colors. And store owner. The owner of an art store. This was a thing she was considering, opening her own store, because she felt like in doing so she could market her own stuff. But opening her own store would kill her. There's nothing in this that has anything to do with accounting, hiring, filling out legal papers, you know, all that's involved in that realm. So she's trying to become the best artist she can be and maximize that and then sell it through somebody's store. How about Gil? I'll give you a minute just to breeze through that. Okay, you've gotten just the briefest touch of who this individual God has created is. Giel. What do you think about him? What elements does he like to work with? Numbers? Yeah, I would say numbers is pretty key. Likes to what? Yeah, that's excellent. That would be another stanza. That would become under how he perceives his world. Very good. Yeah, and then you'd want to follow through and you know, have him give you more details about how he learned all these things. Does he learn by observing, by reading, by asking questions, you know, all these things. Wonderfully complex individual. Strategies turns him on. I would say systems. Loves figuring out systems. Languages. Challenges. Okay, that's an environment. This dude needs to be in a challenging environment. Continual flow of challenges. He needs to master things. The guy's a master. He comes in there and figures out in 3 days what it takes the rest of class the semester to do. He figures out a particle analyzer better than the individual who created it, so that he knows how it can work better than this guy who built the sucker. The guy's amazing. Yeah, he's here in the LDI. Your challenge is to find out who he is. Now, he wants to be a Bible translator. Would he be good at it? Why? Well, that's routine. The challenge, okay, challenge, okay. What else would we know that he would be good at it? He'd have to master it, yeah. He's in the languages, yeah. So there is probably a real significant fit in that realm for him. Right, he'd have to have his name on the results. Ghostwriter, he would be terrible at. Absolutely horrendous. A ghostwriter is someone who writes something for somebody else and they get all the credit and they have their name on it. This man was designed to enjoy recognition that his contribution came directly from him. That's wonderful. When you know that and can give that back to God and say, God, this is how I function best. That is wonderful. That may grate you just a bit right now because you're not used to thinking, dividing values and functions. Functionally, this is how he operates best. A good supervisor will come up daily and say, Gil, man, you're an expert at this. You're the best. And give him independent challenges and let him function and put his name on it. It's great. With just a little limited information about two individuals, you have a pretty good indication of how they function best and what they should and should not pursue vocationally. The third thing about yourself that I want to cover real quickly before you have to leave is desires. These 30 people that sat in that living room couldn't answer the question what do you really want out of your involvement in God's world. My friend Susan, who's been selling insurance for 13 years, has been doing somebody else's thing for so long that she, at 36, does not know what she wants. She took drama in the university, but decided for the practical. Practicality would be what someone else wanted for her, but wasn't what she wanted. She took a degree in economics and wound up selling insurance. She's probably the most creative individual I've ever met. And all that she is does not fit into all that the insurance job requires. Some think that to follow your desires is ungodly, wrong, carnal. And yet we have an indication in Romans 15:20 of Paul, who said, my ambition is to preach the gospel where it's not been preached before. Charles Swindoll says, talks about dreams. He says, by dream I mean a God-given idea, a plan, an agenda, a goal that leads to God-honoring results. People who soar like eagles, people who live above the drag of the mediocre, are people of dreams. They know what they want to give to God's world. Dick Wolf is a fellow who wrote a book called Find Yourself, Give Yourself. He said, getting in touch with your righteous desires provides you with the knowledge of some of the most powerful forces in your life. The fact is that God does occasionally enter into human history and dictate and say and tell His vocational guidance to certain individuals, like Paul, or like John the Baptist's parents, or like Jeremiah, or like Samson. And if that happens to you, if you're on your way home and you get knocked out of the bus and you see a bright light, and you go blind, and you hear these words, and it tells you to go do something, then do it. But the norm seems to be God leading through our desires. What is it you want to contribute? Some of you simply have not had enough time in our world to be captured by something yet. You know you're captured by a desire to contribute something when you can't do anything else. If you do it, you'll be miserable. Let me rephrase that. Unless you do what's on your heart, you'll be miserable. I've come to a point, I'm 36 now, that I know what my vocational purpose is. What I want to contribute to God's world is helping people find where they fit in His world of work. You have on your next page a little thing like this. Usually, many of you are probably not in your 30s, but it's in your 30s when you begin to focus this stuff. You begin to say, okay, what is my vocational purpose? What do I want to contribute to God's world? But you must start now to try to begin to identify that. Someone has said that the thoughtless man will be controlled by the thoughts of others. The man and woman who doesn't think about these things will be controlled by others. If you don't decide what you should be doing first, other people and circumstances will decide that for you. Your parents, not the parents are negative or bad, I'm not saying that. But many of you may be following what your parents have wanted for you. And it may be wrong, vocationally. I'm not talking values, vocation. Many of you are stuck you're about to graduate, or you're in a realm and you say, well, okay, I can't afford to stay longer to get the degree I really want. And you're letting money decide for you. The thoughtless man will be controlled by the thoughts of others. You need to take some time. Even now, where you're at in your life, probably in your 20s, to ask yourself, what do I really want to give and get from God's world of work? Just a phrase. And then draw a little trademark. How would you picture this in a trademark? And then dream. What would I like to be doing along this line 5 years from now? And then a one-year plan, and then the monthly pursuits. You know, we're afraid of dreaming. I think I've lost my rubber band here. Here it is. We feel like here's reality, this hand. And if I dream, I'm going to be stretching reality. I'm going to be loose touch of reality, and pretty soon I can snap, you know. It'll be painful. Well, you need to put that dream out there and in daily and weekly and monthly take steps to move the reality towards that dream. That's why this system here is systematically moving you towards that five-year picture you've got there. Well, the bottom line is this, that where you fit vocationally in God's world of work, your niche, is a realm of vocational stewardship where who God has designed you to be, what God has designed you to be, your functional design, joins with your desires for contribution, forming a vocational platform from which you can represent your Creator effectively. Your niche, design plus desires. You'll see on the last page of the handout, if you want to continue your niche hunt, I've given you my address and phone number and what I can offer you. I've also given you some suggested resources that will be very, very beneficial for you in identifying your design and your desire.